Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. Bob is off on assignment, but will be returning to us soon. And today, we're going to be talking about the recent Supreme Court declining to hear an important case related to protests and mass protests, which is McKesson versus Doe. Joining us is Maggie Ellinger-Locke. Maggie, welcome to the Green and Red podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Maggie is a movement lawyer based in Washington, D.C. She works for the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University School of Law, where she helps train the next generation of movement lawyers. She's also worked with Greenpeace USA and in public policy and private practice. And she's also currently the co-chair of the DC chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. My first question, this is actually a pretty important decision not to decide. I guess you could say that the Supreme Court did this week. Could you actually just tell us, start off with telling us a little bit about McKesson versus Doe? Just give us the background.
Sure, happy to. So in July 2016, Alton Sterling was killed by police officers of the Baton Rouge, Louisiana Police Department. This killing was captured on video, and those videos went viral. DeRay McKesson decided to come to Baton Rouge, and McKesson had made a name for himself during the Ferguson uprising when he quit his job in Minnesota and showed up downriver with his distinctive blue vest in St. Louis, Missouri, my hometown. So he's known in the media as a BLM protest leader. And by this point, almost 2 years after Ferguson, he was also running for mayor in his hometown of Baltimore. So the protests are taking place, and this particular protest goes to the highway, and it appears pretty uncontested that McKesson urged people onto the highway. And some people started throwing objects, and eventually that included a rock or a piece of concrete that hit a cop, causing pretty severe injuries. Like the cop lost some teeth, and among other things. That cop would then sue McKesson in federal court under Louisiana's negligence law, the general personal injury law there. And the district court dismissed the case, pointing to NAACP v. Claiborne Hardware, which at least we all thought was a First Amendment protected protective law case that's pretty foundational to the freedom of association established by this court, i.e. that First Amendment protected activity can't give rise to a personal injury cause of action. The cop then appealed to the Fifth Circuit. Federal district courts are divided up into appellate circuits, and each set of states takes its cases from the Fifth Circuit here. It's the most conservative, hands down, of the various circuits around the country. It's Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. The Fifth Circuit reversed the district court, saying that their interpretation of Claiborne is wrong, and that the cop did state a cognizable claim, which was that he could recover money from McKesson for his injuries. If that was true, then McKesson could have reasonably foreseen that his urging people onto the highway could result in a clash with police, which would in turn result with police injuries. Then petitioned the Supreme Court, SCOTUS, to review the case, and they agreed, but in a very limited way. They issued an unsigned opinion from all the court, except for Justice Thomas, which expressed concern about the importance of the case and whether the Fifth Circuit had accurately described Louisiana state's personal injury law. So they send it back to the Fifth and suggest that the Louisiana Supreme Court be asked whether or not the Fifth Circuit got their interpretation of the personal injury law correct. So this is what the Fifth Circuit did. They certified this and another question to Louisiana's top court, which said, yes, the Fifth Circuit got it right, which sent the case back to the Fifth. And then they say, we were correct the first time. So then McKesson petitioned the Supreme Court again, now with the First Amendment question fully ripe and presented. So there should have been no easy outs on that. Mm-hmm. But that would happen. When it came time for the court to consider the petition, to take it to conference, to decide whether to hear it, the court pushed it off and relisted it 8 times. When you get more than 2 or 3 relists, that usually means the court will deny the petition, but might say something about why, or maybe a justice dissents. And that's what happened here. The court denied the petition, so it said it wouldn't review the second Fifth Circuit opinion after having made such a show of how important the question was just 4 years before. But there was no dissenting view. Instead, Justice Sotomayor issued a statement, an odd but increasingly used tool by justices to say something about a denial. Of thousands petition denials each year, a statement like this only happens about 10 times. So what did Sotomayor say? Basically, she suggested that the personal injury law can't prohibit speech that incites others to illegal conduct unless the speaker intended that conduct to occur. And she suggested that the Fifth Circuit may have overstepped on that, but understandably, because SCOTUS issued a decision clarifying that point just a few days really before the Fifth issued its second decision, which is notable. But so now the case goes back to the Fifth Circuit, which will remand to the district court to see if the cop can prove the facts that support his Louisiana personal injury claim. What is clear is that moving forward in the case, the First Amendment is no bar to the cop's theory. He still has to prove his theory, right? It's just that the First Amendment won't stop him. And others in Louisiana can file the same kind of case whenever they feel that a protest leader did something that could reasonably result in, and then in fact did result in harm. So that's where we are now.
And so just a couple of questions. We don't know who threw the rock, right? They've never actually caught the rock thrower.
You got that.
It could have been an undercover Klansman, for all we know.
For all we know, absolutely.
Right. A provocateur.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. And this is going back to the Fifth Circuit, but what if it is found to stand, what will be the impact on DeRay McKesson? Like, so what will he, I have questions later about the sort of overarching impact on movement organizing, but what will be what will he be personally liable for or personally responsible for?
So what ultimately this is headed towards is the case is going to proceed, right? Mm-hmm. Unless there's some sort of settlement or something reached or the cop decides to dismiss. So potentially McKesson is on the hook for damages. And I believe that the original complaint is seeking $75,000 in damages, reasons for that. But so, yeah, this could proceed to discovery. We could see this case drag out for years more. It's already been many years, clearly. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen, but it's very likely that it's going to move forward on the trial court level, and we'll see what comes from there.
And we're talking about civil damages with this case, but is there also the potential for, maybe not with this case, but like other criminal damage, criminal punishment or anything like that?
No. So DeRay and 30 some others were arrested during the protest on the highway, and mm-hmm. those charges would later be dropped, which is the much more common way that
it's pretty normal with highway blockades.
Right, exactly. Yeah. They arrest people, they spend the weekend in jail, maybe, and then they're released and charges not too frequently are dropped, right? That's something that we see quite a bit, which I think has a real chilling effect in of itself. But yeah, no, the criminal pieces of this are resolved. This is about the civil liability moving forward against.
Okay. And the sort of case law that was set in 1982 with NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware was, right. I believe it was Medgar Evers' brother, Charles Evers, who had made some sort of comment about violence, breaking people's necks or something that had brought the case about people not going and using these white-owned businesses or we're going to break their neck or something like that.
Yeah, that's basically right. There was a boycott going on. And Megar Evers' brother, Charles, thank you. Yeah, it made a series of speeches where, yeah, if you violate the boycott, members of the Black community, we're going to come get you, essentially. And yes, there were some isolated incidents of property damage and property damage that happened during the boycott. And that was what was at issue in the case. And ultimately in 1982, the case had been going on since the 60s, the Supreme Court ruled that ACP, which had called for the boycott, could not be held liable for the actions of those who engaged in the property damage and the other unlawful activities that occurred during the boycott itself, of course, being lawful. It's this freedom of association case. It's a foundational case that's the first year law students studying constitutional law will learn about, right?
I learned about it in an undergrad constitutional law class.
There you go.
It's foundational.
Yes, that it's been in place for over 40 years. And in here, we're now seeing the impact of it potentially start to erode under what's happening here today.
And then the other important decision that SCOTUS had made, Supreme Court had made, was in 2023 around Counterman versus Colorado, which is actually somewhat contradicting of McKesson versus Doe.
I think that's a decent interpretation. So that case, it concerns a stalking conviction. There's a Colorado man who was stalking a local musician and making threatened comments, and it's heard that she received as threats, but he argued that he didn't intend them that way. He was harassing her on social media and talked about how he'd seen her in person. And she ended up canceling appearances, started carrying a gun, like really had a great impact on her, it appears. And Justice Kagan authored the opinion there, and she found ultimately they threw out this conviction of the Colorado man. And Kagan said that the Colorado should have used an objective test in determining whether Counterman's statements were true threats, which could include protected speech rather than the subjective standard of recklessness, and as the correct test. And in her concurrence to that, to Counterman, Sotomayor saw things a bit differently and did not think that the court should have touched the true threats doctrine, which was not actually an issue in the case. So it's interesting, I think, that here we have Sotomayor again lifting up Counterman, which wasn't decided exactly as she would have chosen, pointing to this true threats doctrine, which again isn't really what we have operating here in McKesson, right? Where we're talking about negligence and the liability of a protester, of a protest organizer, urging people on to the road, and whether or not it was reasonably foreseeable that people who were then on that highway would take actions that would lead to the violence, to the impact that the cop experienced, to the harm the cop experienced. So like a tangential way that we got there. So yeah, they're not in conflict, but they're not completely aligned. So I think, yeah, you're right to pick up on that.
And so the scope of this, if we let the Fifth Circuit decision stand, the headlines are at least saying Texas, Louisiana, Missouri, which I assume is the Fifth Circuit's jurisdiction. But is there potential where this could be case law nationwide?
Okay, so the Fifth Circuit, it's Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas.
Oh, okay.
Just to clarify. But so
I maybe misread that, sorry.
No, just Missouri. Okay. The Eighth Circuit. I'm from Missouri.
It is Mississippi. I'm sorry.
Mississippi. We're clear. But so it's three states in the Fifth Circuit. So what this case did, though, is it said, so the Fifth Circuit is saying that the First Amendment doesn't bar the state of Louisiana or actors in the state of Louisiana from imposing liability on a protest organizer when they could have reasonably foreseen their actions would lead to police injuries, right? So to state that really dirty, you can't make yourself immune from legal consequences by speaking while engaging in illegal activity. That's what this is. The speech is separate from the act that accompanies it. John Wilkes Booth, death to tyrants, kills Lincoln. His speech didn't make that constitutionally protected. How far does it go? So right now it only actually is in Louisiana. The Fifth Circuit is interpreting Louisiana law, but the other two states in the Fifth, Texas and Mississippi, it's going to depend on their state laws. And as we know, as to them, the Fifth Circuit thinks that they could have this same interpretation around that kind of law without violating the First Amendment. So it's up to them to decide if their state laws would countenance this sort of approach. But outside of those states, this theory of liability absolutely can spread, right? Though there will be hurdles along the way. So a state court needs to say, yes, we agree. Our law is the same as Louisiana's for personal injury. And then either a federal court would need to agree with the Fifth about whether the First Amendment blocks the theory, or the Supreme Court would need to hear the case to resolve it once and for all. And we already have an example of this from Oregon, where after a fight between Fash and leftists outside of a leftist hangout bar, the bar sued Patriot Prayer using the same theory. And a state court of appeals recently, it was January of this year, upheld the dismissal based on the First Amendment, where they explicitly rejected the Fifth Circuit's reading of Claiborne, in McKesson. And if the state court had gone the other way, Patriot Prayer could have asked the Oregon Supreme Court to review. And if they lost, then it would have gone to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it'll take a case like that for the Supremes to return to the issue. But what that means is we're seeing the beginning of a split here, and different states and different circuits are going to reach different interpretations. Mm-hmm. So the Fifth Circuit may remain an outlier, or the split may widen. We will see. And then just another part of the scope of the ruling, I think, to name is how this could be applied in other contexts. Corporations that fight protests are watching this closely. And if a protest organizer acts to escalate confrontations in a way that would reasonably result in, say, property destruction, maybe those companies will start using this theory for damages recovery. And I imagine state legislatures are watching too. Maybe the American Legislative Exchange Council is, because if the First Amendment doesn't stop a civil suit on this theory, then it wouldn't stop a similar theory for criminal liability either. This could expand.
Yeah, that was my earlier question.
Sure. Yeah, we're not quite sure where this is going to go, but I think it's really important, and that's why we need to watch closely.
Do you foresee any immediate effects from this?
Absolutely. I think there's an immediate chilling effect. I've already heard from people worried, oh my goodness, am I allowed to go to a protest in Louisiana or Texas or not sort of or elsewhere? And I think there's been some pretty the word I want to use is sloppy reporting. The First Amendment still exists. People still have the right to protest. And I urge people to take full advantage of their right to express themselves. What this case does, it's talking about liability for protest organizers in the state of Louisiana specifically, potentially in the Fifth Circuit, broadly, but whether or not police officers for sure, but also perhaps property owners, or maybe even other injured protesters can seek damages if they can argue that it was reasonably foreseeable that these damages would occur, that this harm would occur. That does not mean people don't have the right to protest. But I do think we have in this immediate moment, people are nervous and I get why. It's a pretty scary thing to hear you don't have the right to protest anymore when that's not the case.
Two days ago here in the Bay Area, protesters blockaded and shut down the Golden Gate Bridge, which, you know, and they also blockaded other highways in the East Bay side, which led to this overwhelming police response, fire response, cutting people out of devices, which they were locked to, things like that. Could like a city sue protest organizers for the cost of doing business that day? Would that be something that would fall into this?
Okay, not an expert on California law.
Or anywhere. I'm not just talking about California, but
sure. What California has and a couple other places do too is that they have a pretty robust anti-SLAPP statute,
right?
Which is what the Oregon court I was mentioning before relied on too in dismissing the case against Patriot Prayer, interestingly. But so SLAPP suits are on the rise, strategic lawsuits against public participation. Mm-hmm. Strategic lawsuit against public participation. A little bit of a mouthful. But that's really what McKesson...
We've done shows on SLAPP, by the way.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, that's really what McKesson suit is, right? This is about speech, protected speech activity, and thinking of and weaponizing the courts around it, whether that be for civil liability, for protest organizers, criminal liability, et cetera. But the classic example of a SLAPP suit is where you have like a major corporation tying up protest organizers in court for a very long time. We're seeing that at Greenpeace, my former employer, go to trial on this summer in an effort to silence their dissent and their speaking out in Greenpeace's case against the fossil fuel industries. But yeah, that's what these are. And these are various forms of SLAPP tactics, and we're seeing them on the rise. And of course, they're going after the climate movement, seeing them going after labor. Palestine solidarity next. Absolutely. Foresee that.
We also have a case, I'm blanking on what the case was, but where if unions go on strike, then they could potentially have to pay the business for the loss of work. I think it was a Washington case, maybe Washington State case.
Sure. I believe it.
Yeah. I can't think of what it is. We did a show on that one too,
though. Okay. I should check it out.
My last question, there was actually a great piece that came out today in These Times by Adam Federman about the sort of state's war on protest, which actually cited McKesson versus Doe. And what do you see as I would say my wrap up question, but what do you see as some of the long term impacts of this, of where we're headed with cases like this?
So certainly the chilling speech that I mentioned before, right? Like this is going to, I think the result is that people are going to be afraid to make their voices heard. They're going to be scared to go to the next protest. And I think one way this might play out too is that protest organizers, particularly more liberal to moderate ones, might be watching this and say, well, now I really need to police my own protests, mm-hmm. right? We're going to mm-hmm. see marshals and people who are ostensibly part of a protest movement cracking down on their comrades even more, causing dissension in the ranks kind of thing. Like, that's how I see this playing out. This is going to increase conflict and tension within movements. That's really dangerous. That's mm-hmm. straight from the COINTELPRO playbook. Like, that's the sort of way I could see people interpreting this and responding to it. Yeah, we do need to get the message out that people still have a right to protest despite this bad ruling, and they should continue to hit the streets.
Excellent. I'm going to leave it there. Okay. Maggie Ellinger-Locke, it's been great talking with you today. Really appreciate the update on this. You definitely, right to protest and right to dissent are definitely like a kind of key topics that we talk about a lot on the Green and Red podcast. So really appreciate you joining us today.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope I was helpful. Feel free to have me back anytime.
Oh yeah, totally. And folks, you're listening to the Green and Red podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit subscribe. If you're listening to us on one of the audio platforms, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. Everybody still, despite all of this, continue to misbehave and make trouble. And we'll talk to you all again real soon.
Absolutely.